For parents during a pandemic, it's a showdown with patients.
It's been a very stressful summer with a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old.
Keeping them off their devices 24/7 is hard.
It's been really hard to remain a full-time worker with 2 really young kids.
I am grappling with how to keep them busy and engaged when there's really not a whole lot that they can do and they can't hang out with friends.
I understand it. We need to talk about it. It's Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway for Monday, July 6th. Also on the show, how the killing of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen is reverberating across the military and beyond. Plus, we take a look at some of the hard truths about the quote-unquote girl boss movement.
You get a group of women who largely mirror the socioeconomic demographics of the men who have always led corporate America, but now it's women.
Parents across the country have gone months without childcare, juggling the tasks of being a parent with those of learning how to homeschool on the fly, often while working full-time. And as the pandemic drags on and in much of the country gets worse, parents are burned out, exhausted, anxious, and trying to figure out how to continue down this road as summer plans are canceled and schools may not be reopening full time in the fall. And we asked you, parents, how you're dealing with the stress of the current pandemic.
Hey, this is Barbara. I'm calling from Tacoma, Washington. I'm a stay-at-home mom with 3 teenagers, so I don't need to arrange for childcare, but keeping them off their devices 24/7 is hard. So that is what I am grappling with, how to keep them busy and engaged when there's really not a whole lot that they can do and they can't hang out with friends.
Hi, this is Brian from La Crescenta. What are my plans with the kids for the summer? Keep them occupied and off of video games. Try to keep them learning so they can make up for what they've missed and they're ready for their next grades. And try to keep them out of my hair so I can get some work done.
Thanks for sharing your experiences. Keep them coming at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. And today we're going to talk more about what parents are facing, including the mental health implications of this pandemic, with Jessica Gross, lead editor of Parenting for the New York Times, and Cheryl Ziegler, author of Mommy Burnout and a doctor of psychology and registered play therapist. Jessica, Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me too.
So, Jessica, when we last spoke, COVID-19 stay-at-home orders had begun, and many people had just started working from home. What's changed since then, other than just more months of this situation?
Well, what's changed is school is out, and it's been out in a month in much of the country. It's been out a little less time in New York and New Jersey, but it's a mixed bag about whether that is helping parents. So the American Psychological Association did a survey, and while almost 70% of parents said that they were relieved that they weren't doing distance learning anymore, 60% said they were struggling to keep their children busy, and 60% said they have no idea how they're going to keep their child occupied all summer.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Jessica.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we're talking about children of all ages here. I mean, there are parents who are grappling with kids who are school age, with kids. Some listeners may hear a baby crying in the background. That's my child. So parents are really under a significant amount of stress right now, Cheryl. We're 4 months into the pandemic. Let's talk about mental health. Parents who are trying to manage children at home, the restrictions of a global pandemic, working full time, summer being out. Where are we right now?
So mentally, we are in a state really of crisis. And when we last spoke, we were dealing with more acute trauma, meaning, oh, something novel's going on, and now we're trying to respond to this, and it was new for everybody, and that was different. Now where we're at is we're actually looking at people experiencing post-traumatic symptoms, meaning that their lives have been turned upside down socially, financially, emotionally, and stress is high. So we were looking initially at thinking, wow, this is going to be a year or so of a fallout after this educational disruption, as well as, you know, just change of routine. And now we're predicting that potentially this is years of fallout in terms of anxiety and depression. And let's really not forget suicide as well. Suicide's still leading cause of death. And so that is still happening. Nothing has changed there. So we really have some mental health crisis because we have much of the population that was already dealing with mental health challenges, and now this on top of it.
And Cheryl, I want to talk a little bit more specifically. I tweeted last week asking people generally how their mental health was doing, whether they were parents or not. One of the things I think is adding to this, and as a mental health professional, you can shed some light here, is the isolation of this moment and the uncertainty about everything from what's going to happen later today to what's going to happen in the fall. Does that further affect parents psychologically?
Yeah, so we're looking at loneliness as being a major predictor for how people handle stress and how people can also manage through resilience. And so when you have people feeling disconnected from others, that's family and friends, and potentially feeling alone in this and then being physically distanced, it's really a combination for not being able to tap into resources that were there. And there are some people who didn't even have those resources prior to this. We know that we have a generation, particularly in young adults, that reports being quite lonely and quite disconnected. So we really are looking at mental health meets the lack of social connection, which is the bridge to how people get through things. And so that's what we have to figure out, is how to get people even more connected while staying socially distant.
Jessica, I want to talk about different kinds of family situations here. Not everybody is the same. And of course, I myself am a new mother. I'm a single mother. Is there any evidence that the pandemic is affecting single parents differently than it is affecting parents who are in a couple?
Yeah, I mean, I think to just build on the sort of lack of resources, you know, single parents, even in non-pandemic times, just don't have as much time to get a break. And now they have even less time to get a break, time to themselves, time to rebuild and reflect. And the other group of parents that I think is really struggling right now are parents that have less means. I just saw a statistic that almost 40% of Americans earning less than $40,000 a year lost their jobs in March. And so I think parents who already have less resources in numerous ways are really struggling in this moment. And I think as this drags on, that's even going to be highlighted more. The inequality is going to stretch further.
I shared my personal story with the New York Times parenting section, and so have other parents, Jessica. And there was a recent piece in the New York Times by Deb Perlman, who essentially talked about having to choose between having a job and taking care of children during COVID-19. It got a very mixed reaction. There were some people who said, you know what, I see that, I understand that. There were other people who thought, well, that's a bit of a privileged position to be able to leave your job in order to take care of kids. What does it tell us about the national conversation about pandemic parenting right now, Jessica?
I think everyone is having a hard time, is what it tells us. I think in some ways it's revealing that a whole group of people was having a really hard time before the pandemic. And that conversation was perhaps not front and center the way that it should have been. And now that everyone pretty much is affected, except for possibly people who are so wealthy that they have staff living with them, I think that the conversation has become bigger, but certainly it makes sense that people who have been having this conversation for years about how, you know, parenting is not working for folks, it feels a little bit like, oh, everyone else is coming to this party.
Cheryl, to Jessica's point about these conversations happening before the pandemic and just reinforcing a lot of the things that we're dealing with, there's also the question here of childcare. And I think there's also a question of anxiety around childcare. Do I bring someone into my home? Do I not bring someone into my home? How do we manage, Cheryl, the increasing levels of anxiety with every step you have to take as a parent to literally navigate the day to day?
Well, I think also, you know, I want to talk about that, but the other piece about how people are experiencing this differently is, I think this is an opportunity in terms of managing anxiety and stress and possible discord between parents to say, yes, some of our situations can be different, but no matter what, we are all under stress, and that's all relative. I think managing anxiety is a lot around control. And so when people feel anxious, it means they feel out of control. And so whatever parents can focus on that they can control is extremely helpful. It's also very helpful to their kids, their teens, whatever age of child that they have. And I don't want to forget the young adult children as well, because they're really struggling right now through transitions, either going to college or coming back from college. So you really want to focus on what can you control? There's a lot that we can't right now, but what can we? And that really is key.
Jessica, the section at the New York Times Parenting has really been doing a lot on this. I'm wondering, are there any big takeaways, no pun intended, that you have for listeners that you're seeing emerge in terms of how parents are dealing with pandemic parenting?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are really looking to whatever solutions they can create for themselves. I put this quote from a piece that we ran from a dad who said, "We tried to settle on the bad and not the catastrophic decision." So folks are dealing with having to work, having to watch their kids, having to deal with mental health and physical health. And so a couple of solutions people are doing is they are relying on family to help with caretaking. So that's something my family has done. We moved in with my parents, but that opens up a whole other realm of risk. Elderly people are more at risk for the coronavirus. And so that's something that sort of weighs on folks. People are creating pods of caretaking, almost communal living, where, buddy up with one or two other families and you trade off. That requires a lot of trust in people, that they are sharing the level of vigilance over the virus that you are. Some folks are continuing to send their kids to daycares that are open, though that industry has been completely decimated by the pandemic and there is much more need than available spots. And then as a last resort, folks are leaving the job market, which I think is not ideal for most families, and it is disproportionately affecting women. And so those are sort of, the sort of menu of solutions that parents are turning to at this time, and none of it is ideal.
It doesn't sound like any of it is ideal given the circumstances. We've got about a minute left. Cheryl, in about a minute, I'm wondering if you can tell us, are the effects different? We haven't talked a lot about dads or moms here, but do dads and moms experience the stress right now equally?
I think that in general, this is generally speaking, women are emotional gatekeepers, and so they are holding a lot of the stress of, is my child okay? Are they behind in school? Can I get them caught up? Are they still going to have friends when this is done? They hold that emotion and how their children are doing. And I think in general, dads are wondering, how are we going to make ends meet? How are we going to be able to, function going forward? How is this going to affect my job? So I think, pretty equally, moms and dads are experiencing stress, but some of the things that weigh heavy on them at night can be the difference sometimes between finances and emotions.
Cheryl Ziegler is a doctor of psychology and registered play therapist, and Jessica Gross is the lead editor of Parenting for the New York Times. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Houston, Texas, this weekend, more than 1,000 protesters gathered calling for a new investigation into the death of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen and changes to how the military handles sexual assault allegations. Guillen disappeared from her Fort Hood base in April, and police now say she was brutally killed. Before her killing, Guillen told people close to her that she had been sexually harassed on the base, and the suspect in her murder, another Army specialist, took his own life last Tuesday. With the discovery of Guillen's remains last week, her death has become a national story, and the chorus of voices demanding justice for her family are growing louder. With us now is Nicole Acevedo, digital reporter for NBC News, who's been reporting on this story. Nicole, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, Nicole, briefly, Vanessa Guillen went missing in April. What has happened since then?
Well, what happened on April was that Army officials launched what they called an extensive search for Vanessa Guillen on the Fort Hood base. She disappeared on April 22nd, and really her case didn't raise to national attention until June, that celebrities like Salma Hayek and Latino civil rights groups like LULAC and members of Congress started getting involved in the case because the family felt that it was not being treated with enough urgency from the part of army officials who were investigating the case. And the sequence of events the last week was very, very quick. Like you mentioned, a suspect in her disappearance died by suicide. Remains were found. The family lawyer said that they believe are those remains found near the base where she went missing are Vanessa's, and people are calling for answers in her case because people were really looking forward to finding her alive.
Nicole, now that the remains have been found, one of the questions that has been coming up in this case is that Guillen, before she was killed, if that's in fact what has happened to her, told people that she had been sexually harassed on the base. What do we know about that?
So family members said that in the days before Vanessa went missing, she had told her mother and sisters that she didn't feel safe in that base, that there was somebody harassing her, but she didn't necessarily feel comfortable reporting that person through the programs and the official mechanisms that exist within the base right now. So according to the military, they say that they have no credible evidence or information that that happened to Vanessa. But if you ask the family, they say they do. It's just that the way things are structured at the base did not allow her to fully come forward with what happened to her.
Nicole, we mentioned that the suspect in Vanessa Guillen's killing, another Army specialist, took his own life, died by suicide on Tuesday. How quickly, I mean, who is this person that we know so far? What was their supposed role in this?
So according to federal officials who filed a complaint and filed charges last week to a possible his girlfriend who possibly helped him get rid of Vanessa's body, still the intentions as to why he would want to possibly kill Vanessa are still unclear. According to that complaint, what happened was that this woman, her name is Cecily Aguilar, got a call from her boyfriend, who's the specialist who died by suicide last week, saying, hey, I need your help getting rid of this body. Vanessa's body was in a box near a river near the base. And essentially this guy, apparently they got rid of the body as they could. And on Tuesday, when the remains were found, Army officials were looking for him. And as they were looking for him, he ran off the base and decided to die by suicide. He pulled out a gun and apparently used it against him. So we don't know. That basically doesn't give us a lot of answers as to what were possibly the intentions for doing harm to Vanessa. But the girlfriend, well, the complaint describes Cecily Aguilar as the girlfriend of Aaron Robinson, who was the man who died by suicide. But Army officials described Cecily Aguilar as the estranged wife of a soldier at the base. So she's due in court today, this morning in Texas, to see through some of the charges of possibly helping Aaron Robinson in getting rid of Vanessa's body.
Nicole, this case has created a huge wave of social media of women, some of who are Latinas and other women in the military who are coming out with their own stories of harassment. What effect is that having, if any, on the military's response?
It's I mean, from the military side, we saw Fort Hood officials say last week that they involved the Inspector General's office to basically review the protocols already in place at the base to report sexual harassment and sexual abuse and note if there's any systemic changes that should happen at that base. what we've seen the Guillen family do with the help of their lawyer is that they're demanding a congressional investigation to see what really happened here and the Army's handling of Vanessa's case. And with that, they're also pushing forward for a bill that would basically create an independent entity where members of the service could go to and have their claims investigated. And the reason for that is that the family believes that because essentially you have a system in which the Army investigates itself when it comes to these allegations, that it might actually discourage soldiers from reporting their harassers.
And particularly women. I mean, this is something we've seen. I'm just curious to know what you're seeing and how people are reacting to this. There was a vigil over the weekend. This seems to have created a really profound effect on particularly her family and the Latino community.
Oh, yeah. People are absolutely mourning the death of Vanessa Guillen, especially the Latino community. You know, her family, she was born in Texas. Her family has heritage in Mexico. And, you know, it's this mourning her death, her possible death, but also mourning the fact that they feel like she was doing so much for her country and the country didn't protect her. The systems in place that were supposed to protect her didn't protect her. And I think what we're seeing right now is people really questioning those systems and analyzing if they want meaningful change and continue to live in a place that, you know, somebody like Vanessa could die working at a military base.
Nicole Acevedo is a digital reporter for NBC News. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Last September, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced plans to annex Palestinian lands, promising to, quote, apply Israeli sovereignty to the Jordan Valley and the northern Dead Sea immediately if elected. While some speculated that that was just campaign talk, today Netanyahu's annexation plans, which have been condemned by the United Nations as a violation of international law, could be coming to fruition. If Netanyahu does follow through, thousands of Palestinians in the Jordan Valley and areas north of the Dead Sea could face displacement and effectively become stateless. Joining me now to talk about the consequences of annexation and U.S. public opinion on Israeli policies is Omar Barghouti, a Palestinian human rights defender and co-founder of the BDS movement based in the West Bank. And Shibli Telhami is a professor at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Omar, Shibli, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Shibli, let's start with you. A brief explanation, if you will, of annexation and why it's on the table right now.
Well, first of all, Israel has been occupying the West Bank and Gaza since 1967 in that war. And obviously, annexation is illegal under international law. And the U.S. Also agreed with that up until the Trump administration. Annexation means essentially making the territory part of Israel. And applying Israeli sovereignty over that territory. So clearly there is international opposition to this all over the world. The difference here is that you have an administration in the United States, not only that supports annexation in violation of international law, but actually proposed it. You have a Trump plan for the Middle East that actually proposed significant annexation of the West Bank, almost 40% of the West Bank to be annexed by Israel. And obviously that has generated a huge storm internationally, but even domestically, and even within Israel itself, I would say up to a point, The reason for that is very, very straightforward. Up until now, you know, people have said the best solution for the conflict is a two-state solution. A lot of people have said it's died a long time ago, and I would say even more experts of the Middle East say that's true. But American political elites still believe this is the solution. And when you have annexation, it becomes impossible, and it forces U.S. elites to choose between Israel as a Jewish state and Israel as a democratic state, which obviously would become very problematic if you have a Palestinian majority. So that has really created a major crisis.
Omar, you are a co-founder of the BDS movement, which stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And the movement is to end international support for Israel's influence in Palestine. Now, you live in the West Bank and Ramallah. What could annexation mean for Palestinians there?
As Professor Telhami said, annexation has been going on for decades, but it's been mostly informal, de facto annexation. What Israel is planning to do now is formal or de jure annexation, and both of them are equally illegal under international law. De jure annexation or formal annexation would basically, as you stated in the introduction, make thousands of Palestinians who live in the occupied territory of the West Bank that Israel plans to annex, it will make them stateless. It will make them non-citizens in the state of Israel. This, as dozens of UN experts have said, crystallizes a 21st century apartheid, quote unquote. Indeed, many international experts, many parliamentarians, more than 1,000 parliamentarians in Europe, have said that this annexation must be opposed very strongly, because otherwise it undermines the international law system as it is, the law-based system as we know it since World War II. So Israel should not get away with this. Similar acts of annexation throughout history have been met with sanctions, except when it comes to Israel, nothing has been enforced. Palestinian civil society stood in a unified way and issued an appeal to the world saying, we cannot stop annexation, neither the ongoing decades-old de facto annexation, nor the coming, the looming de jure annexation alone. We need to cut the links of complicity and impunity that allow Israel to continue this theft of occupied Palestinian land and this apartheid system that has existed for so long.
Omar, well, let me ask you this. Like, what exactly is the BDS movement doing right now in the face of this potential annexation?
We launched a campaign to impose targeted, lawful sanctions against Israel, because we're against indiscriminate sanctions. So we specifically called for a ban on arms trade and military cooperation with Israel, suspension of trade and cooperation agreements with Israel, prohibition of Israel's illegal settlement products from entering any country, cutting U.S. military funding of Israel's regime of apartheid, and that's basically a very necessary demand, because the U.S. is the main funder and defender of Israel's violations of Palestinian rights. And finally, resuscitating, reconstituting the UN Special Committee Against Apartheid to investigate Israel's apartheid. Since we launched this appeal, we had massive responses across the world, including from 7 former Latin American presidents, 2 South African presidents, hundreds of parliamentarians, political parties all over the world, in Europe and elsewhere. So that the response has been great, because I think most people realize if Israel gets away with this, it will enable other states that look at other territories that they do want to annex, it will enable them to do so and use Israel as an example.
Shibley, you mentioned that President Trump and his relationship with Netanyahu as part of the reason why this annexation is happening or potentially happening right now. I'm wondering, in your research at the University of Maryland, what have you found about how Americans feel more broadly about Israeli policies under President Trump?
Well, first of all, you know, there are actually a couple of questions, including about BDS, because we've been doing polling on this. So with regard to BDS, to stay with that subject, I've done a poll last October at the University of Maryland to see how much people know about it, because it's become an issue, particularly after the midterm election. And there's a debate even in the mainstream about it. And there are about a half of the American public who say they've heard a little about it. And of those who have heard about it, more people oppose it than support it in general. About half oppose it. But among Democrats, it flips. More Democrats support it than oppose it. And when you ask them, is this a legitimate movement or not, you find that overwhelmingly Democrats say it's an illegitimate movement. Overwhelmingly Republicans say it's not a legitimate movement. So that's just as a background on where even the partisan divide, even on BDS in the U.S. But with regard to the Trump plan, that too, by the way, most Americans haven't really followed this. I mean, we're focused on our immediate crisis, the pandemic, the racial issue. So what we found is really 70% of the public say they follow this very little, if at all.
Shibley, before we go back to the question of annexation, I want to ask you about COVID-19, which is a worldwide pandemic. Can you give us a sense of how the Israeli government has been handling the pandemic so far?
Early on, the Israeli government was lauded for doing a very good job in confronting it. They had relatively few cases. They were aggressive. Still to this day, actually, Israel has a relatively low percentage of deaths. I think it's about 2% as opposed to, we're closer to 5% in much of Western Europe accordingly. And so anyway, they've almost declared victory. They started going back. And then suddenly there is a huge resurgence to where it's a major crisis, where health officials are now warning that there could be a collapse in the hospital system if action is not taken soon. But one of the fascinating things, though, is the question of whether Netanyahu, who was in the middle of a crisis, personal crisis with the courts, as well as a political crisis in putting a coalition government together, whether he used the fear of coronavirus early on to propel this coalition government that was unlikely without that. And now you've got the return of the coronavirus and a coalition government that is dysfunctional.
Omar, COVID-19 in Palestine, what is the outlook there right now?
In the Palestinian occupied territory, the Palestinian Authority initially had a serious lockdown and was quite successful. But now we see that it's really getting out of control. Cases are increasing by the hundreds every day, and the Palestinian Authority seems to have lost control.
Shibley, what are we expecting to see in the coming weeks when it comes to annexation?
The pushback was incredibly huge, maybe more than Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, expected. There's a pushback not only from Europe and the U.S., and particularly unanimous opposition among Democrats at a time when Democrats appear to be poised to win back the White House, in 2020. Certainly from the Arab states with whom the Israelis have tried to get closer, particularly the Gulf Arab states, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, have been sending signals that this could be a problem that could set back the relations that they have built up. So it's unclear whether the prime minister will do so, whether there will be some kind of a domestic compromise, which obviously doesn't solve the problem, because from the international community's point of view, even an inch of annexation is annexation. They might split the difference. It wouldn't really change the name of the game. It might create a lot of different responses within Israel itself, but I doubt it would make it a big difference internationally. The looming problem, as I see it, is a possible crisis emerging with Iran. I don't know whether anyone is really interested in a confrontation, but there has been a series of mostly cyber attacks, but more recently apparently a bomb attack attributed to Israel, the New York Times reported yesterday. It could generate at least an attempted retaliation response. That could also change the game in many ways if there's an escalation. It'd make it even harder for the Israelis to actually impose annexation. I think chances are that the Prime Minister of Israel wants to announce some kind of annexation because his political base is expecting it, but it's a fluid situation.
Shibley Telhami is a professor at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Omar Barghouti is a co-founder of the BDS movement based in the West Bank. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
In 2014, Sofia Amoroso, founder of the online fast fashion site Nasty Gal, published the book Girl Boss. It would sell more than 500,000 copies and become sort of a how-to guide for ambitious young women trying to excel in male-dominated corporate America.
A girl boss is sort of a subcategory of female corporate leader. Young, progressive, forward-thinking, upwardly mobile, ambitious women who cared a lot about fashion and cared a lot about feminism, but also were really interested in their personal success.
That's The Atlantic's Amanda Mull there, and we're going to hear more from her in just a moment. Girl Boss became the template for women in the workforce, hoping to take back some of the power for themselves. That ethos was touted by leaders at companies like The Wing and Reformation, which claimed to demonstrate a commitment to progressive feminist values. As conversations about inequality and racism in the workplace have gained more traction, a number of female leaders have left the companies they founded after being accused of fostering environments that were harmful to their non-white employees. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and she recently published a piece called The Girl Boss Has Left the Building. I asked Amanda about the appeal of the Girl Boss movement back in the 2010s.
Well, there's a couple things that contributed to the Girl Boss perfect storm of sorts that happened in the mid-2010s. The year before Sophia Amoruso's book came out, Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook published Lean In, which sold millions of copies and suggested to a curious audience that the way to master your career and have it all, as it were, is just to dedicate yourself more fully to mastering the existing power structures of corporate America. And so those two books were sort of a 1-2 punch that landed with a group of young women who, raised by baby boomer mothers, who largely worked during their childhoods, who had, as a generation, created a lot of progress for women in the workplace. And those women arrived on the job market, those daughters arrived on the job market, you know, after the Great Recession, when the future of sort of professional prosperity that had been promised to them had evaporated. And I think a lot of them were sort of looking around at the world that they lived in, which was not quite the world they had been promised, and were trying to find a way to forge ahead and still find that sense of personal success that they had been striving for much of their lives.
Who are the girl bosses that we're generally talking about here, Amanda? I mean, when I say who, I mean, I feel like a lot of the names that we'll talk about here are largely white women of a certain amount of privilege and social capital, and not to mention maybe economic capital, financial capital as well. Am I right?
Right. The people who succeed in corporate America, no matter their gender, are generally white people, generally people who come from a solid financial background, people who are well pedigreed, who went to the correct universities, who got good grades, who got the correct internships and had the familial financial support to take those internships and live in expensive cities for no pay, and who don't have to worry as much about student loans and things like that. So you get a group of women who largely mirror the socioeconomic demographics of the men who have always led corporate America, but now it's women.
And you've written, and I'm going to quote here, that, quote, slotting mostly white women into the power structures usually occupied by men does not de facto change workplaces, let alone the world, for the better if the structures themselves go untouched. And I think I would love for you to talk about that in this context, because it feels like that's the same conversation we're having at the national level when it comes to systemic racism.
I think that a problem that we're sorting out in America is that American culture loves to blame things on the actions of individuals. So when you see a problem of corporate America and of, you know, widespread workplace abuses and difficulty for people of color and difficulty for women rising up the ranks to the same levels of success as their white male peers, the urge is to blame men or to blame particular men. But really the problem there is the structures and incentives that create that success. Those structures were created by largely white men. But when you put other people into those positions and ask them to climb the ranks like the white men who came before them, in order to succeed in those situations, they're going to make largely the same decisions that the people who came before them made, which means that results in the same types of abuses, the same types of labor problems, the same types of discrimination that we've always seen in American workplaces. So just changing the identity of a person who wields that power and a person who responds to those incentives is not going to change the power itself or the incentives themselves, which is what you'd need to do in order for the experiences of the people who work for those companies to be meaningfully improved.
Amanda, some of the places where we've seen women, female leaders step down were once celebrated themselves for how progressive those places were. And I'm talking about places like The Wing, Refinery 29, how essentially they were, you know, pushing forward a very progressive idea and cause and space. And yet a lot of the environments that they were working in, the workers at a lot of these places have told stories about how difficult and toxic the environments were and how they did not align with the, at least the outward facing message that these companies wanted to portray. There have been accusations of toxicity and fostering environments that were difficult for Black and Brown employees. Like, tell us a little bit about what these women did.
Largely, they did the same things that male executives have done for ages. They get into trouble because in the aftermath of Lean In and Girl Boss and their success and the success of those ideas, in the hope that, you know, elevating women and quote unquote empowering women in the workplace would help solve these problems, an effective way for entrepreneurs, for female entrepreneurs to find funding and to find markets and to find willing audiences of consumers was to emphasize their intent to do things differently, emphasize their own feminist values, emphasize their interest in employing more women, employing more people of color. So as these values became widely celebrated in culture, American business pivoted to take advantage of them. I think that probably a lot of these women went into these endeavors feeling really sincere about their intentions, or at least some of them did. But when you enter into a system that, again, incentivizes abuses and incentivizes inequality and incentivizes you to pay people as little as possible and get as much work out of them as possible in order to satisfy your own goals and to satisfy the goals of your investors and your other executives, you're often going to end up making the same decisions that would be made by the CEOs that you defined yourself in opposition to when you were starting your company, which I think is just another illustration of the fact that it's the system itself that sets people up to be mistreated in these workplaces.
A lot of this really connects to, you mentioned Lean In, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In at the very top of this conversation, and that how that influenced the rise of hashtag Girl Boss. And a lot of that is really just what some folks would call corporate feminism. Is there a role for corporate feminism going forward, Amanda, in this moment that we're in right now?
I would say no. I would say that corporations, the best thing that they can do is to begin ceding power to people that exist outside of the power structure that they exist in. And when you get corporate feminism or corporate anti-racism, that is often an attempt by the companies in question to monopolize some of the existing cultural conversation and existing cultural momentum to shore up their own business. So I think that instead of adopting these issues as their own and coding them into the marketing of their businesses, what they need to do is start to make real structural concessions to the people that they have fundamentally excluded in the past.
You're talking about real change, Amanda.
I am. We all are right now, aren't we?
That's right. That's right. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Amanda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's all for us today, and it's always good to have you with us. You can give us a call about any story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll be back tomorrow with more. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.